because what you just heard there was the national anthem of the Islamic Republic of Iran, a song that sings of martyrs and the faith of the Islamic Republic, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And today we want to discuss Iran and what to expect from President Joe Biden on Iran, on issues concerning the Iranian nuclear deal. And joining us today to discuss this issue, where we like to talk about current events for conservatives and others, is Sarah Stern, the founder and president of the Endowment for Middle East Truth, that is EMET, which means truth in Hebrew, to discuss these important issues. Well, welcome to the show, Sarah Stern.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. Well, it's always good to hear from you. Starting out, looking at what do President Joe Biden and his new Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, intend to do about the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or as it's more commonly known as the Iran nuclear deal, which President Donald Trump abandoned in 2018. What does he want to do going forward on that?
Well, President Biden, when he was on the campaign trail, had said multiple times that he wants to go back to this Iranian nuclear deal. And Tony Blinken, when he was asked about it during the confirmation hearing, said he wants to make it longer and stronger. The Israeli government is very concerned because they do not believe, and in fact, Aviv Kochavi, who is the head of the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, just spoke at this Institute for National Strategy and Security this week, and he said it would be a very big mistake to go back to this deal or to try to renegotiate with the Iranians.
Well, has this JCPOA, this Iran nuclear deal, has it been able to hinder Iran's nuclear proliferation ambitions? I mean, are there any strong measures in the deal, or is it fundamentally flawed?
It is fundamentally flawed. I mean, the truth is that there were so many flaws with the deal to begin with. One was they had very early sunset clauses, one of which has already been passed, and that was in terms of the Iranian importing and exporting of weapons. Unfortunately, that expired on October 18th, so they're free to trade in all sorts of lethal weapons with all sorts of rogue players, including Venezuela. They're very close with the Maduro regime. And just another issue is that they have been helping Venezuela, which is right here in our Western Hemisphere, right to the south of us, under our noses. They have been importing the parts for an ICBM slowly, and that really puts our national security interests at risk. So October 18th was that date of expiration, and there are so many others that are coming up. Unfortunately, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister of Iran, had said that there will be no further negotiations about the dates, meaning the times of expiration, or about the missiles. So I think that it's almost a fool's errand to go back and negotiate with these people, because these people invented the Persian Bazaar. You know, they have rugs that are probably worth $5 that they can sell for $5,000. And they were able also, in terms of this Iranian nuclear deal, the United States in 2015 wanted at least 24 days, 24 hours, just 24 hours to inspect their sites. They said, you know, we will get on-demand inspections, but the Iranians changed it to 24 days. And another huge flaw is that they say that the military sites are off limits to the International Atomic Agency inspectors, the IAEA inspectors. So if they want to hide any kind of their activity, they can always just call any place where they're building a nuclear bomb or enriching uranium a military site. So it's a very flawed deal. Unfortunately, the European Union seems to want to trade with Iran. They will eventually be very threatened by them. They're much closer to them than they are to us. And it's really a big mistake to go back to this.
Well, if I recall correctly, now this entire nuclear deal, this JCPOA, was originally intended to expire in another 5 years or another 10 years. So it's a very limited deal to begin with.
That's right. That's right. And we understand. Look at North Korea. Once you're under a clear umbrella, you can really do whatever you want with impunity. People do not want to mess with you because they know that they can eviscerate you or part of your population. In the case of Israel, Israel is a one-bomb country. It's a tiny country. You know, I think about 1,000 Israels could go up into one Iran. So they know that this is an existential threat. But the problem is when we have most of the world that wants to negotiate with Iran and we have, a tiny country that is within easy striking distance from Iran, they are feeling threatened. And they're also feeling very threatened when they look at some of the players on the Biden team who have had long, long anti-Israel records. So you've got to have a sense of trust. Otherwise, they might act out on their own, and they will do that because they feel that they're under existential threat. And then, of course, the entire world will blame Israel for blowing up the negotiations and saying things like, oh, this could have been resolved peacefully, but you were too impatient, which is what happened when Israel blew up the nuclear reactor in Ashraf, Iraq, and when they blew up the nuclear reactor or the designs of one, the attempts of one, they hadn't gotten very far in Syria in 2007. But they know that, you know, and people with our history, when people say that they want to obliviate us and eviscerate us, you know, we've got to read the writing on the wall and stand up and take it very, very seriously.
Well, what are the estimates for Iran? How close is the Islamic Republic of Iran today to a nuclear weapon?
Interesting question. Tony Blinken said it's a matter of weeks. And the IDF has said it's a matter of months, like 2 or 3 months. But that is only until they reach enough highly enriched uranium. They're already enriching way beyond I think they agreed to enrich at the 3%, which would be for peaceful uses, and they're enriching at the 20%. And the more refined the enrichment, the higher the number, the more easy it is to get to the 90% level for a nuclear bomb. And that's or many. I think they have enough. They have 10 times the amount of highly enriched uranium than they agreed to in 2015. But that's just part of it. They also have to put it on a warhead and on a missile. And we don't know where they are in terms of their missile construction. And I know they have the Shahab 3 or 4 or 5, but I'm not quite sure if they have the capabilities of being able to take this highly enriched uranium and put it on a missile head and launch it. But they have been launching satellites into the sky. So they've become a very, very savvy. And I know they got a lot of their information from this gentleman Khan from Pakistan. And they've been working with Red China, and they've been working with North Korea. They'll work with anybody. They've worked with Russia. They were able to purchase the S-300 missile system or anti-missile radar detector from Russia, and they want to purchase the S-400. And every one of their nuclear installations now has a very sophisticated radar missile detection system. So if Israel does want to attack, it's going to be very perilous. You know, and there are people that are planning. Aviv Kochavi, the head of the IDF, instructed his generals to make several plans of attack, and they're looking at them very seriously right now.
Well, that's an interesting question. What would be the capabilities of Israel to attack the Iranian nuclear program, similar to, as you mentioned, the prior attempts in 2007 when the Israelis struck the Syrian effort to build a nuclear reactor, and then before that, when they, in 1981, when they struck the completed Iranian nuclear reactor outside of Baghdad at Ozarak. What sort of possibilities, what sort of capabilities do people think Israel has now confronting Iran?
I really don't have enough information to answer that question. I know that, you know, it depends who you talk to. I think it's going to be very, very dangerous. I think Iran is a huge country. You know, they have this enrichment facility in Fordow, which during the nuclear deal, they were building it as they were talking in 2015. It's totally constructed. When they were building it, you know, after it came out, they said that they're only going to keep it as a research facility and they would not use it for their highly enriched uranium processing. Well, lo and behold, Fordow is where most of this highly enriched uranium comes out of. And also, the Israelis, we assume the Israelis, somebody struck this summer at the nuclear facility in Natanz, but now they are actually reconstructing it, and it's, you know, it's very, very sophisticated. It's all underground. You know, Iran is a vast region with, you know, varied terrain, a lot of mountains. It could be hidden anywhere. So, you know, I know there are many Israelis that seem to have alluded to the fact that they think they know where everything is, and, you know, they have the capability, but I'm not really sure. Although nobody would have believed in 2018 when Israeli agents from the Mossad raided that treasure trove in the middle of Tehran of nuclear secrets and came out with, you know, reams and reams and reams. I think it was 50,000 pages of documents that showed that even though our national security intelligence estimate or national intelligence estimate in 2003 said that they stopped working on any nuclear program, it showed that they never stopped and that they have plans to keep on going and going and going.
Well, thinking of other options to stop Iran, has the policy of tough sanctions under President Donald Trump, has that been effective? Would a continuation of that policy be able to stop Iran's march, any attempt to obtain a nuclear weapon?
Sure, if anything will. We're talking about folks that really believe in the 12th Imam. Many of them are absolutely sure that the way to bring their Messiah is to destroy Israel and the United States. And so some of the population are religious fanatics. I think that the sanctions policy was wonderful. It was working in a sense in terms of them not having enough cash on the open market to be able to, you know, trade. And some of their Hezbollah members were complaining that they were not getting their payments. You know, they have so many proxies around the globe. Which is a brilliant, brilliant mechanism so that they can say, you know, we didn't have anything to do with this. You know, it's just Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hezbollah in Syria or Iraq or the Houthis or Jabhat al-Nusra. There are so many various terrorist organizations that are on their payroll. And I think that has been a benefit that they – yeah, have not been able to make their payroll occasionally. but they are other countries right now, since the arms embargo expired, are free. They feel free to trade with them. You know, I think I'm very disgusted with the European Union, you know, who, you know, seems to overlook or willfully ignore a lot of their behavior just for the almighty riyal or dollar, and it's, or lira, whatever currency they use. And it's, you know, it's very, very problematic. It's really problematic. But I think the sanctions policy was good. You know, we just have to do everything that we can. We certainly want to, we do not want to literally and figuratively give them the fuel to empower more nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's a key question there. Well, you know, Henry Kissinger recently warned Joe Biden against returning to this Iran deal. What is the general, do you have any estimate, what do most policy or analysts in the United States or around the world share this position? What is sort of the, among a formed opinion, what is sort of the popularity of this Iran deal?
I think the Iran deal, unfortunately, is very popular with people who, you know, think that they can just solve any problem around the negotiating table. They don't understand, you know, that as Margaret Thatcher, the late Margaret Thatcher said, we in the West make a great mistake when we transpose our values onto the rest of the world. You know, many people think, okay, it's a gentleman's agreement. You know, it's, you've got a handshake. But we know that the Iranians have been cheating all along. And, you know, enriching uranium far beyond the limits that were spelled out in the 2015 agreement, you know, and we know that they are not to be trusted. So, you know, I don't, at times, I feel like Ronald Reagan, who said trust but verify. I think when it comes to the Iranians, first we should verify and then we should trust, because we have so many years of their promises now, and we know they have not lived up to the agreement. So it's very, very frightening. I think America should understand its strength. If they wanted to sanction Iran or any nation that Iran, and people would have to look at our economy as opposed to Iran's, I think they would place their bets with us, and they wouldn't deal with Iran. I mean, that was what brought Iran to the negotiating table in the first place. And I know the Iranians are saying that in order for us to sit down with them, we have to totally abolish all of our sanctions, which would be very foolish, because that's their end goal. Excuse me, that's their end goal. So we would be rewarding them with what they want even before we sit down, and that would be the only leverage that we would have. So there's a lot of things, and we really should have the credible threat of a military option. Not that anybody wants to go to war. Everybody hates war. But without the credible threat of a military option, the Iranians are certainly not going to listen to us in good faith. I think it'll just make them a little bit more receptive and responsive to our suggestions if and when we do negotiate.
Well, Henry Kissinger in particular warned that any return to the deal would probably prompt Saudi Arabia to engage in its own nuclear weapon surge, its own proliferation. What would be the effects of Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon? I mean, you mentioned, for example, the threats to Israel. What other threats would emerge?
Well, I think all of the Sunni Gulf states definitely do not want this. I think that was one of the motivations for people to sign on to the Abraham Accords. As the Arabs say, you're the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. I think people are realizing, for a great deal of reasons in the Sunni Arab world, that number one, the power dynamic of being with Israel, who, even though they're a tiny country, they've got a very advanced military, that there, it would certainly help them. And while we had President Trump in the White House, who was an obvious, very, very good friend of Israel, I think they felt that they were going under America and Israel's protective umbrella. I'm very concerned that Biden wants to walk back the missile sale of the F-35 to the Emiratis because it makes us look very untrustworthy. You can't, you know, every 4 years have, you know, a different position. If the United States makes a deal, they make a deal. And, you know, I think it really does not reflect well on us. But I think that all of these countries, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, you know, Jordan, all of them are really threatened. You know, any Sunni Arab state, it's amazing that, you know, people could reevaluate this when a new administration comes to town. But I've seen this over and over again.
Yeah, indeed. You know, with a change in administration in America, you can indeed have sudden shifts, which has been sort of a longstanding concern that other foreign leaders have mentioned on dealing with the United States over the decades, I can recall. Well, can Joe Biden, can he even really negotiate a new deal? As you've indicated, you know, Joe Biden and his Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, they've talked about they want to have a better, stronger deal. Is there any possibility of that, particularly if they abandon this leverage of sanctions and returning to the old deal?
If they abandon the leverage of sanctions, it's over to begin with. I mean, I cannot believe that. I really don't believe that the Iranians are going to negotiate in good faith. I think that ultimately they want their yellow cake and they want to eat it too. They want to have the bomb and they want to have the freedom to trade in the open market without any sanctions. And I hope they do not think we're pushovers. You know, I was a little relieved to hear some of Anthony Blinken's statements in his confirmation hearing. However, I'm very concerned with some of the people that are appointed, that have been appointed in the Biden administration to work specifically on these issues, such as Rob Malley, who has written articles about how we could deal with Iran the way we dealt with the former Soviet Union of mutually assured destruction. I mean, MAD does not work with people like the Iranians who, you know, it's a theocracy. They're on a religious mission. And they also, at one point, Rustam Zani many years ago had said, I could sacrifice a million of my people and it won't hurt us. So they have a very different sense of regard for human life, too, for their own human life. I remember Daniel Pipes telling me years and years ago that when the Iranians wanted to clear the minefields after the Iran-Iraq war, they took these teenagers and they told them that they would, you know, go up to 74 brown-eyed virgins, and they even gave them plastic keys to paradise. And these poor young men, many of them died clearing the minefields. So I feel it's very different when you deal with a bunch of religious zealots than when you deal with, you know, just the average Western type of thinker.
Yeah, I guess that would be, you know, some very troubling issues there. Robert Malley, as you indicated, has been appointed by Joe Biden as his new special envoy to Iran, and he was in the administration of President Barack Obama. He was one of the key architects of this Iran deal, one of the key negotiators for the Obama administration. I guess thinking in particular of his comments on trying to go back to mutually assured destruction, MAD, with Iran, similar to the policies that were pursued towards the Soviet Union and the communist bloc. You know, thinking of the 1963 or 62 Cuban Missile Crisis, that was actually pretty close run thing. You know, that was actually not so much of a master display of negotiating strategy. There are a lot of close runs there that could have kicked off a nuclear war. So I'm not sure if we want to play Cuban Missile Crisis again with the Islamic Republic of Iran in any future crisis situation.
That's right. That is exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that we've been working on with Annette is also looking at the buildup of Iranian missiles right under our noses with the Maduro regime in Venezuela. We want to prevent another Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, here attacking the United States. So, we have a lot of really great concerns. Robert Malley has never met a terrorist or a dictator in a rogue regime that he hasn't warmed up to and felt somehow that he would be able to just, you know, seduce them into, you know, dropping everything just by being, you know, making nicey-nicey. But it doesn't work, you know, with these people. And I'm very, he's like a Neville Chamberlain. And there's another person, his name is Maher, it just escaped me. But he is actually the head of our, yes, Maher Bitar. Thank you. In Maher Bitar, he's the head of, for the NSC in the White House. He is going to be the director of intelligence. And he is a firm, firm believer in BDS. He started the BDS movement at Georgetown University. He's still on the board of directors of Students for Justice in Palestine. And as the director of national intelligence for the NSC, he will get to sift through what pieces of intelligence President Biden lays eyes on, and not only the president, but also other foreign governments. So this is a really sensitive and critical appointment, both of them. And, I thought with Biden we would get more of the Dennis Ross types. You know, I don't mind the Dennis Ross types and the, you know, Aaron David Miller, they look moderate compared to these guys. Dennis Ross wanted a two-state solution, and he thought about, you know, going back to the 1967 borders. Maher Bitar wrote his master's thesis at Oxford University on the Nakba, which is an Arabic word for the catastrophe, which is the 1948 establishment of the state of Israel, which the Arabs refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe. So this is, it's not good to have people that are so radical in this position. You know, Joe Biden really passed himself off during the election as a moderate. And I don't know who's making these decisions, but they're very, very troubling.
Well, that brings up other issues in terms of policy in the Biden administration concerning the Middle East. We've mentioned here Mali, and then Maher Bitar, who will, as you indicated, be senior director of intelligence for the National Security Council. And as you said, he'll be overseeing then all of this highly classified information and its distribution to the president and also to other governments as to what sort of reporting will go to Joe Biden's desk. Also recently it's been noted the Biden administration is appointing as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Israel-Palestine Hadi Amir, who's an individual that has recently worked for the Brookings Institution's Doha Qatar Foundation. Do you know anything about him?
Yes, he's also extremely, extremely biased. He's been, I'm trying to remember exactly, but he has been a radical on these issues, just incredibly radical. A friend of mine, Ruthie, she wrote an article about Maher Bitar, but none of these people, these are people that you see taking over, and we've seen taking over college campuses and these, crazed radical kinds of demonstrations against Israel. But I'm really shocked that the Biden administration could actually appoint somebody like this, who is so biased. He's already been welcomed with enthusiastic praise in Ramallah, and it's very sad. Okay. It's just incredibly, incredibly sad. So I'm not quite sure, you know, what can be done about it. We are working with several members of Congress right now. One of them is actually working on a letter that he's going to circulate. This is Doug Lamborn is working on a letter based on the information we've given him that he's going to circulate to send to the president. I doubt that they're going to rescind any of their appointments that they've made, but it's very, very dangerous. And I should also say, Rob O'Malley, there was an article in the Tehran Times that they were ecstatic that he was appointed as our point person and to lead the negotiations in Iran. And NIAC, also, which Hassan Rouhani, who is the president of Iran, they called NIAC the Iranian, our Iranian lobby in Washington. So they're very, very happy. And of course, NIAC is led by Trita Parsi, and Trita Parsi is also the vice president of the Quincy Institute, which looks to be more objective, but is also an Iranian lobby here in Washington. So it's going to be a difficult time. You know, the groundhog saw his shadow and said six more weeks of winter. I feel like for those of us who care about the survival of Israel, and as I see it, the free Western world as we know it, in the United States, Europe, and even the Sunni Gulf countries, I think it's going to be a very long, hard 4 years for all of us.
Well, yeah, these are all very troubling appointments. I mean, you indicated with Maha Bitar, for example, his position in his student days at Georgetown University, where he first went to undergraduate and then later obtained a law degree there. He was a leader there of Students for Justice in Palestine. I believe he still sits on the board, which you noted that organization, which is actually the student arm of American Muslims for Palestine, is the key right. sponsor of the Students for Justice for Palestine, which itself then is an organization that's kind of actually sort of an American Hamas derivative, or Hamas supporters in America helped found it. So, you know, this is a very radical appointment. Are any of these appointments subject to congressional approval? Can they be blocked by the Senate, or are they all just appointments that Biden can make without any oversight from Congress?
That's right. They are not subject to congressional approval. And, you know, the problem with some of these appointments is I'm not sure what he really believes, but Tony Blinken was asked specifically during his confirmation proceedings what he felt about BDS, and he said, both I and President Biden are vehemently opposed to it. And then they go ahead and they appoint people like that who basically made a career out of BDS. So I don't know who's doing this, whether or not Biden is letting and Tony Blinken is letting somebody else make these appointments. I don't know, but it's very, very scary.
Yeah, you mentioned again with Bitar, you know, his sort of life work in BDS, is, you know, as you said, his Oxford University master's thesis was on this whole idea of the Nakba, the catastrophe, which has now become sort of the key political weapon against Israel, this idea that the very creation of Israel in 1947, 1948 was sort of this original sin out of war crimes of ethnic cleansing, that Israel deliberately drove out all these Arabs, and so really, the entire existence of the country of Israel is illegitimate. That's become sort of the right. key argument against Israel in the modern era. So for a person to advocate that, and now he's going to be at the National Security Council, is really quite extraordinary. And another development that just came out is apparently Matt Duss, who was at the Center for American Progress and then has been recently a Bernie Sanders supporter in Democratic politics, is now also apparently headed for a post at the State Department. He was known for, at the Center for American Progress, he had condemned Israel's treatment of the Gaza Strip as being equivalent to, like, segregation, Jim Crow segregation in the American South. So once again, we have another troubling possibility there at the State Department.
Yes, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I had known as we saw what was going on, Andrew, both you and I and a few others have been following what's been going on in universities in America and the radicalization of our youth. But they've turned out people who actually believe these things. And, you know, it doesn't really matter how false they are. And, you know, it's like Goebbels had said, the great lie theory. If you repeat a lie often enough, people tend to believe it. And particularly if it comes from your professors, you know, who have these degrees, your parents have saved for you to go to school. You think it's a very valuable education you're getting. But, you know, for many of these people, what comes out of their mouths is just a total, total distortion.
Well, thinking of these issues of the Iran deal and other appointments, as I mentioned before, in terms of Congress, what could Republicans and other opponents of a return to this Iran deal do about this? For example, our mutual acquaintance Fred Fleiss at the Center for Security Policy, a former CIA analyst, has written that, for example, maybe the Senate should demand that any new Iran deal or any new steps towards Iran be actually made into a treaty such that they would be subject to Senate oversight, whereas the previous Iran deal, although it was ratified by the Islamic Republic of Iran, sort of a rubber stamp legislature, its Majlis, it was simply an executive agreement here in the United States, so not subject to any congressional, any Senate oversight. Are there any possibilities for Republicans and others to place any pressure on the Biden administration for any upcoming steps he might take towards Iran?
That would be wonderful if we could. I mean, looking at the makeup of the Senate right now, you know, it's a 50-50 Republican-Democrat, and then, of course, Vice President Kamala Harris, you know, has the deciding vote. So it would be very, very hard to get something like this through. It's amazing. This should not be a Republican or a Democratic issue. This is an issue of survival. You know, I not just of Israel, not just of the Sunni Arab nations, but really of the free world as we know it, because they would like hegemony. That's why they're, you know, the Iranians are setting up bases in Africa and in South America. You know, they have, you know, really, really, they believe that they're on a religious mission. And, you know, I wish it weren't. You know, we've spoken to many people this week from Amit. We've spoken to many people on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, some reasonable staffers for reasonable Democrats said, well, I'm going to have my boss talk to the president about this. These are really valid concerns. I hope it gets translated to them to do it. And, you know, I think the more people know, the more likely the American public would be up in arms about this. But I think there's just this veil of ignorance that's been thrown over of the American people. We're so obsessed with things like the impeachment and COVID-19, et cetera. And these are all very important issues, but, you know, these are existential issues. And, you know, what starts with Israel never ends with Israel, and what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews. It's just unfortunate, but that's the way it is. So I think it would really bemoan all of us to look seriously at some of these appointments and to try to get a two-thirds majority for a treaty, because, you know, these negotiations are really arms control treaties, and according to the Constitution, we do need two-thirds of a vote. But Obama very craftily went around the U.S. Senate and instead went directly to the United Nations. And it was a huge, huge betrayal.
Yeah, well, thinking of it, you mentioned bases again, returning to this discussion that's brought up of Iran sending ICBM parts to Venezuela. What do people think might be the intention there? Is there really a fear that Iran might try to station missiles eventually in Venezuela? And what is the Venezuelan government claiming that they're doing with such parts? And how might the United States and other countries react to that, to any possible threats here in the Western Hemisphere?
I think people have got to, you know, open up their minds to what's going on. This is a real huge existential threat to the United States. I have people on my staff that have been working, you know, in various intelligence fields, and they know that they have been assembling the parts. You know, it's a very it's a critically important issue to us. It's it can be a potential threat. You know, we'll see. And both Iran and Venezuela are evading American sanctions by doing this. You know, the Maduro regime in Venezuela has been sanctioned, and Tehran is sanctioned, but they have ships where things are slipped in, you know, from Tehran to Caracas. And this is a huge issue that we've been talking to people on Capitol Hill about. So there are ways, I think there are policy ways where we can prevent this from happening, particularly, you know, if we work with our allies who might have agents in different ports around the world where they can see what's going on and report back to the United States. And that's why it's so important that there be people within the new administration that the Israelis can trust. It will absolutely behoove us in the future to have, you know, people that we could trust, our allies around the globe, so they don't feel that they're going to have to go it alone, and they don't, you know, act out aggressively on their own, and on so many levels. And it will help us in terms of intelligence sharing, intelligence gathering for issues such as this.
Well, thinking about allies, you know, you talked before about Europe wanting to trade with Iran. How are European countries, or for that matter, countries in the Middle East and other elsewhere around the world, reacting to the Joe Biden administration and any possibility that it might try to resume a deal with Iran? For example, Prime Minister Boris Johnson of the United Kingdom a couple of years back said that what we really needed was to replace this joint comprehensive plan of action, this Iran nuclear deal, with a new Trump deal with Iran. Has there been any reassessment in Europe as well? Also, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, had argued that any new Iran deal should involve the other nations of the region, like Saudi Arabia. Is there any reassessment in Europe or in the Middle East going on about future moves towards Iran?
Well, I think one of the things that was a joy to listen to when Tony Blinken was confirmed was that he said he would like to involve some of the other nations in the region. And I'm sure that, you know, Saudi Arabia and Israel would particularly like to be involved in the discussions. I know the European Union would like to be involved, and I think there is a little bit more of a sense of reality, since it's come to light how much the Iranians have been treating on the last deal. But the Iranians feel very, very confident that they will be able to pull the wool over the European Union's eyes. In fact, I think it was Mohammed Javed Zarif, who, you know, the Iranian foreign minister, who said, well, we don't want to negotiate with the United States, but we will negotiate with the EU. as long as they lead up the negotiations, because I think they think that they're pushovers, really. So we will see. You know, there are a lot of question marks up in the air, but we'll see how things play out.
Yeah, that's a very telling comment that Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, is preferring the European Union as lead negotiators on any deal. And as you mentioned in your recent writing, Robert Malley, the new special envoy to Iran for Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, met with Foreign Minister Zarif a while back, even though he was only a private citizen, which would be a violation of this a famed Loken Act that everyone's always talking about, like particularly with the whole Trump administration and Michael Flynn, that private citizens are not supposed to meet with foreign officials while claiming to be in the capacity of negotiating for the United States. Another worrying aspect there. How are if we think of talking about American Jews and how they've had their concerns about American policy towards Iran in recent years, and now we have in the Biden administration, Anthony Blinken himself is Jewish and talked about his background with his family and the Holocaust and his family members enduring that trauma. How are American Jews responding now in these first few days of the first few weeks of the Biden administration to all of these steps that Joe Biden has taken? Has there been any sort of negative reaction for a demographic that voted overwhelmingly for the Democrats as they usually do?
I think most American Jews do not follow these issues quite as carefully as I do, you know, and I think many of them are oblivious to some of these appointments. I think during Tony Blinken's confirmation hearings, he basically wowed the pants off of most American Jews when he spoke about his stepfather's experiences in the Holocaust, and I think his mother is a refugee from Hungary, and I've read that he has a cousin who served in the IDF. So I think American Jews have this false sense of comfort, and I don't think very few people are aware of these other lower level appointments. They're pivotal and critical positions, but they don't involve Senate confirmation. They haven't gotten too much exposure. But I think when they do find out, they will be very, very upset, extremely upset. I mean, 77% of American Jews voted for Joe Biden. And for many, many American Jews, they've traded their Judaism for liberalism a long time ago. But if some of my most terrific fears come to fruition and these names come out and they're being spoken about and more of the general media, I think they'll be very, very upset.
Yeah, I mean, that's things people have commented on before, you know, the whole, among many modern American Jews, the whole tikkun olam ideology, even though the whole idea of tikkun olam is not necessarily a central component in Jewish theology, and the idea that they interpret Judaism as just being sort of the Democratic Party with holidays, as the saying goes.
Exactly. Exactly.
The crack. Yeah. what other policies? What other effects will the Biden administration have on policies involving Iran? For example, in the last days of the Trump administration, we had this designation in Yemen of this Houthi organization, Ansar Allah, the helpers of Allah, that's fighting in this civil war in Yemen that overthrew the government in Yemen. The Trump administration has designated it as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO. But now the Joe Biden administration is considering reversing that option. They've already made a decision that they'll, at least for the next coming month or so, they'll allow for financial transactions to go through to this Houthi organization. The argument is made that they're the only ones who can administer relief efforts in Yemen and to prevent any famine. How is that decision playing out? Is that a good idea to not recognize this Ansar Allah, this Houthi organization, as a terrorist organization, which is a proxy for Iran and Yemen?
It's a horrible idea, and the truth is that because the killing of Jamal Khashoggi got so much press because he was, you know, a reporter for the Washington Post, so the mainstream media knew him, and they latched on to Saudi Arabia as being the quintessential bad player, bad actor in the region. The truth is, human rights in the Middle East and most of the Arab and Muslim world are horrible. You know, I have a wonderful young man that works for Met, Hussein Abu Bakr Mansour. He's from Cairo, Egypt. Egypt, as you know, was the first country to sign on to a peace treaty with Israel back in 1979. Yet their media is replete with anti-Semitism. And if you could be arrested for the most minor thing and tortured, which happened to him. He was arrested because he reached out to some Israelis to become friends, because he's, unfortunately for him, he's a critical thinker, and he started reading about Jews when he was younger because he wanted to be a jihadist, and he wanted to know about these people that he hated, so as he says, he can hate them better. So he was arrested and tortured, and there are people throughout the Muslim and Arab world that are arrested and tortured. I mean, I am certainly no fan of the Muslim Brotherhood, but there are people rotting away in jail right now in Egypt because they're members of the Muslim Brotherhood under the Sisi regime. So people they don't understand the nature of the world, and they know that Saudi Arabia has horrific human rights abuses, but throughout the Muslim and Arab world, there are horrific human rights abuses. But people like to see things in terms of blacks and whites. And they see now that the Saudis are wearing the black hat. But so are the Iranians. And the Iranians are working towards a bomb. And what you had alluded to before, everybody now in the Middle East wants to start their own nuclear weapons program. And they saw, you know, what happened to Libya. Libya gave up their nuclear weapons program, and then they were invaded. and they see what's happened with North Korea, that everybody, you know, treats them with kid gloves. And this is going to probably happen to Iran soon if they're allowed to reach nuclear breakout. And I think that the Israelis might feel that there's nobody else to defend them but themselves, and they will probably get upon themselves to do something to at least set it back considerably.
Well, what would be the fallout from not recognizing this Houthi organization, Ansar Allah, as a terrorist organization? What threats would it pose?
I'm not really particularly sure, but I know that every single Iranian proxy, if you put the conglomerate together, it just empowers the Iranian regime, you know, and they are going to, you know, fight to the finish because they believe they're right. They believe that God is on their side. Allah is on their side. Allah Akbar. And they will, you know, they feel the intensity, you know, of a kamikaze pilot together with the religious zeal of a crusader. They just really feel that this is the morally right thing to do in their playbook. And I think the world is going to wake up. We have too many Neville Chamberlains running around and not enough Winston Churchills.
Well, we mentioned Saudi Arabia here in this context, which is, of course, along with the United Arab Emirates, has been supporting the anti-Houthi forces in Yemen in this civil war or internal conflict there. Is Joe Biden, is there indications that Joe Biden is really going to start to maybe put pressure on Saudi Arabia, crack down? I mean, you mentioned the Jamal Khashoggi case of this Saudi journalist who was actually really kind of a Muslim Brotherhood operative, financed by Qatar for writing in the Washington Post, who then got brutally murdered in a Saudi consulate in Turkey when he was lured there to finalize a divorce with his first wife so he could marry another woman. Are there indications that Biden's really going to crack down on Saudi Arabia, and what effects would that have?
That, I'm not sure. We've been hearing a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with Saudi Arabia and the way they've been conducting themselves, and particularly about the war in Yemen. But there, we'll see. I don't know if he's going to, because I would hope, that there are wiser heads that will prevail within the Biden administration that will understand that the real emerging threat is the threat of nuclear Iran, and that, they really want to be, part of the allies, together with some other more moderate players, even though, the Saudis do not appear to be that moderate, but, in terms of real politics, they are on the side of the angels. They hate the Iranians, and they're feeling threatened by the Iranians. So one would hope that, we will be careful in our dealings with Saudi Arabia, and we certainly don't want to throw them into the arms of Red China or anyone else that, wants to flex their muscles in this new geopolitical chessboard that's emerging in the Middle East right now.
Well, you mentioned earlier this dramatic Israeli raid, caper right in downtown Tehran in 2018, where they were able to break out this treasure trove of Iranian documents on there. On their nuclear program, this motherload of intelligence findings that had help, if I recall correctly, from Iranian opposition, I believe from the MAC, the Mujahideen al-Haq. What sort of possibilities might Iranian opposition figures play in one, hindering Iran's nuclear program, and two, more broadly, is regime change in Iran really the ultimate viable policy for the West at large, the United States and its allies like Israel, and what sort of possibilities are there for the opposition in Iran to affect any such regime change?
I would love for there to be regime change in Iran, but it has to come from within. I know that there are wonderful freedom fighters. I remember when Obama first came to power, there were masses and masses of protests on the streets against the mullahs, the reigning mullahtocracy in Iran. And some of them were holding up signs saying, "Obama, where are you?" I think there is a possibility of overthrowing the regime. If we were smart and we used the right people within Iran, we would need, CIA agents on the ground. I mean, that's in a pay grade way above mine, to work with these people. But there's a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction among some people in Iran. I mean, their human rights records are horrific. Women have been thrown into jail and tortured for, not wearing their chador or their burqa. And it's just, I think that we could claim the moral high ground and help these poor activists that are in jail. And people have to know that they exist. A lot of people are totally unaware. I have some wonderful Iranian expatriate friends, who really hate the regime and, are in touch with people there that hate the regime. But America has to show that they're going to be out there and support them and won't turn their back the way Obama did in those first, very first signs of stirring. And there were so many since then. But, people have been carted off to this notorious Evin prison, never to be seen and heard from again. So it's very frightening, very scary to go against this regime, and they really need to know that they get backing from the United States. I mean, we did it with the Soviet Jewry movement. Human rights was part of the reason we were able to shake the former Soviet Union. And Jackson and Vanek did it in a way that eventually led to Glasnost. So I think as long as we recognize the humanity of people around the globe that need support, need help, and we don't turn our back to them, you know, there's hope.
All right, then. Well, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to look at issues of important issues of the day for conservatives and others, and with Sarah Stern, the founder and president of the Endowment for Middle East Truth, Emmet, discussing here Iran. So we hope you'll tune in next week for another episode next Friday. Well, Sarah Stern, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Andy. You take care.